How y'all doing?
Yes.
This is a motley crew, okay. My name is Russell Spatz, I'm an alcoholic. Oh Lord, it's good to see you guys tonight. This is going to be dangerous. We are on the sixth step, and I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 17th, 1981, which isn't a record around here. My sponsor series got 55 years, but it's a record for me, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience in this program, and hopefully I'll touch upon the sixth step somewhere along this deal, maybe, you know. And that's the plan, not that I have anything in mind. It's going to be a dangerous meeting because I'm just going to talk off the top of my head, and I'm here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, you know. And I asked one of my sponsors. I've had three sponsors in AA, wonderful, wonderful men. And you ask somebody, somebody will say, "Will you be my temporary sponsor?" I said, "I don't know how to make it permanent because, you know, two of my sponsors died of, you know, cancer, and after many years of sobriety, and that's what happens." And one of my sponsors, Joe Snyder, wonderful man. I once asked him, I said, "Do you ever get resentments?" And he said, "Get them, I give them." Which was amazing to me even then. I think I had 3 or 4 years because I was at that stage where I still hadn't lost fear of people. You know, they say you lose fear of people in economic insecurity. I hadn't lost fear of people. You know, of course, you spend most of your time not even realize you're scared of people, but after you lose fear of people, what happens is you realize how scared you were as people. But you don't realize what kind of fear you have of people until you lose your fear of people, because it's just the way you think. But when he said that, he said that, you know how they say resentment is the number one offender? Well, I think the number two offender is worrying about whether somebody has resentment against you. So because, you know, if there's one thing I know about alcoholics, it's not only do they get these resentments, but they want everybody to love them. And God forbid somebody, I should perceive that somebody doesn't like me. I was speaking once in Toronto. I don't know whether I had 10 years, whatever the hell I had, at some regional. There were about 3,000 people on a Sunday morning. And I was given my, you know, whatever, my testimony, my talk, you know, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And, you know, I did my thing. I got up there, spoke for the hour, and, you know, and everybody seemed to receive it well. I was just talking. And I saw in the back of the room somebody at the last 2 minutes of my talk get up and walk out. I just watched him. He just got up and he walked out. And as they're driving me, and I'm thinking, you know, people are coming up, "Thank you, I really appreciate it, they seem to like it." I wasn't even thinking about that. What did I say? You know, why did that guy leave? You know, it was just on my mind. I mean, I wasn't, you know, listen, this ain't Well People's Anonymous. I wasn't that well yet, you know. And on the way to the airport, the guys who were driving me, "We really appreciate what you had to say." And I'm thinking to myself, why did that guy leave? You know, what did I say to piss him off? You know, and now I didn't understand that has something to do with fear of people and what they don't like and all that sort of stuff, which is a really crummy way to live your life, quite frankly. But A, you can solve that problem. But So one of the dangers is, so when my sponsor said, and I said, "Do you get resentments?" And he said, "Get them, I give them." I was like, that was like an amazing thing. Like, here's a man who doesn't worry about whether people like him. How is that like even possible? I mean, that you could actually say you don't care whether people don't like you. And that would keep me up till 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd be on the phone picking up and says, "Did I do something to offend you?" You know what I mean? You know, I'd be making phone calls, do anything, prostitute myself just so you wouldn't not like me. You know, and that's a big thing with alcoholics. That's why when alcoholics go through 16 years of treatment centers and they're told and it's drummed into them, they're going to die if they drink. They come out here and the first question is, what do I say if somebody says, "Have a drink"? Now, any sane person would take out a gun and shoot the son of a bitch, you know what I mean? For even approaching you like that. But we need to say, we need to ask the question, what do I say? You know, because, you know, I said to my sponsor, "What do I say?" And he says, "Listen to me, Russell." He says, "Say this. no thank you. And I said, what do you mean, no thank you? No, I mean, what do I, because I needed a cover story. I need to know what to say. Because here's what's behind that. What's behind that is I need to tell you something so that you won't dislike me for not drinking with you. Because I would rather drink and die and flush my entire family and future down the toilet rather than risk the possibility that you might laugh at me and not like me. And let me ask, and that's not even funny. You know, people slip and slide in here and drink and flush the whole family down the toilet because some guy who's not even paying their Visa bill says, you want to drink? And somehow they find themselves drinking, they don't even know why, because they don't want to risk the displeasure or the possibility that they won't fit in. This is a very, this disease might be even more serious than you perceive it to be. So, you know, when, you know, so the truth of the matter is, it's one of the things that happens to me as you get sober and you lose that, and I'm not saying you lose it 1,000,000%, absolutely. Maybe it goes from worrying about whether somebody likes you, whether you're offending somebody, you know, every 5 seconds to like once a week or something like that. But, you know, there's a freedom. There's a new freedom. There's a new happiness from that bondage. But I'm not saying, but what happens is, and this is like a warning, I guess. What happens is when you get to that point where you're not filtering what you say through the, what will this sound like? What will they think about me? You know, can I say this? Can I say that? You end up saying shit that offends people. So if I offend you, well, you know, you gotta, well, you know, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. It's like a spiritual MRI. It's like if you went to a doctor and you wanted to see what your spiritual problem was, if you wanted to see what your problem was and you had a brain, they put you in a CAT scan or something like that, and you pay thousands of dollars for that, and they'd say you got like a tumor here. We're gonna save my life. So like when I say something, and you say, I can't stand that asshole. What the hell are you saying that for? That's like a spiritual MRI. Because whenever you're disturbed, you have a problem. So you say, why does that bother me? There's something wrong with me. And you can sort of like, you can four-step that and fifth-step that and you can six-step and seven-step that deal and finally learn what it's about and maybe give it up and start. And one day you wake up and you don't have that deal. It doesn't offend you and you're a different person. So I guess that means you would like owe me a co-payment, you know, something. A few bucks, you know what I mean, for that, helping out with that deal. And that happened to me the other day. Somebody said something to offend me, and at first, you know what I was? I was offended. I hate being offended. Don't you hate that? I just hate that, you know? So you know what happens when you're offended? You do that stuff you do in your mind, justifying your action, and they were wrong, and I was right, and all that sort of stuff. And you know, ultimately, I got to the point after praying and thinking about it, I said, thank God for people like that. Man, I'll tell you, when you can get the point in this world where somebody can offend you and you can feel offended and you can feel hurt and you can say, thank God for people like that, because now I can work on that and maybe become a better person and try to win. You know, when you get that point, that's a blessing. That's a blessing. We worry so much about avoiding people like that, and at certain times it can be very, you know, one of the things Bill Wilson said when he talked about emotional sobriety, he said the next step, the next emotional, the frontier is emotional sobriety, and it says the real problem with alcoholics is making, is having unhealthy relationships. So we do get into unhealthy relationships with people we shouldn't really hang around and stuff like that, but sometimes it's the greatest thing in the world when a sponsor or a person you run into says something and pisses you off, and just pisses you off. And you know, you can be pissed off and mad and feel sorry for yourself and all that sort of stuff. You know what I mean? And you know where that's going to get you? It's going to get you drunk. Or it's going to get you to a point where you maybe stay sober, but you're not going to realize the benefit of that deal. But maybe you'll get to the point to think about, why does that bother me so much? And pray about that and fourth step and fifth step about that. And you'll learn something about yourself that instead of, you'll go farther than just being pissed off. You'll actually go into, why does that piss you off so much? And maybe one day you'll wake up at 5 years or 10 years or something like that, and somebody else will do the same thing, and it won't even bother you. And maybe one day you'll wake up and somebody will say something, do the exact same thing, and you won't even notice it. And somebody will say, Did you hear what that guy said to you? And you'll say something like, what? Because you won't even know that, you won't even pay attention to it. And life can get pretty good when you don't pay attention to a lot of stuff. And you only major on the majors and don't major on the minors. You know, that kind of thing. So I'm going to read a couple of things that I have here, but I don't know why. I was just sort of thinking about, by the way, you know what the sixth step says? We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. So apparently it has something to do with defects of character. It has something to do with them being removed. And it certainly has something to do with God and being entirely, whatever the hell that means. And I don't know why, but I started thinking about something that happened to me, you know, because I think our experiences are real important. So I started thinking about experiences in my life, you know, growing up sober in AA. And it's just an experience I had that I want to share with you. I'm a married guy, you know, and I have four children, six grandchildren, and I got married. I think I was 30 days sober when I got married. My sponsor said, don't make any major moves during your first year. I didn't think it was a big deal. I've decided it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I don't know whether I would have made it single in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just don't know. Now, I'm not counseling anybody to run out and get married right now. But it's a whole different deal. It's a whole different deal. I mean, everybody's different. It's a whole different deal dealing with the single deal. You know what I mean? And the dating and all that sort of figuring that stuff out. Going right into, you know, how do I live with this person? She's crazy deal. You know what I mean? And trying to stick that thing out, you know, and that kind of deal. It's a whole different deal, you know. And I've been married for 30 years. I've been sober 30 years. And in May, I'll be married for 30 years. So, you know, that's the deal. And she's a wonderful gal. She's wonderful. She just gives me a lot of shit. It was kind of rough for the first 29 years. But it's gotten a lot better, you know what I mean? Well, you know, part of being an alcoholic is being frustrated. My way or the highway, or, you know, you break relationships, you hurt people, you walk out the door because you get pissed off. I'm not going to put up with this crap, you know what I mean? I've got my way, you know, you get pissed off. So there is something to be said for persevering and sticking to, you know. My wife said the other day, she says, do you think we'll be together in heaven? I said, hey, honey, it's till death do us part. Till death. I'm here till death. There is... The only thing that keeps me going is I know there's like a limit. You know what I mean? Don't even try to find me after death, because I'm going to be on the other side of heaven, you know, behind the mailbox, you know? And you ain't going to be seeing me. No, that's the deal. Which happens to be biblical, scriptural. No marriage in heaven. But that's, I'm not going to get into that. So in any event, I was about a year or two sober. And it was early in the morning. I think I had three kids living with me at that time, three or four. I don't know. There was a bunch of them. And they were small, and you hardly even noticed them, you know. And I was living with my wife and these three little monkeys in the house there. And I was sober a year or two or three, and it was early in the morning. It was like 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was quiet and it was nice. It was that time in the morning when nothing's going on, everybody's asleep. 6 or 7 in the morning, the birds were chirping, and I was sober, and it was wonderful to be sober. And you know, I realized how incredibly, you know, this is going to sound bad. I just had a feeling about me that how wonderful it was to be sober, how grateful I was, and how spiritual I was, and how much this thing had really helped me, and how much I loved God, and how much I loved this and that and the other thing. And I was just floating on air, and I walked out the garage door, and I went to pick up the paper, and I looked at the trees and the sky, and you know, I just felt so sober, so grateful, so free. And I picked up the paper, and I went to go back to the door, and I went to open it up, and somebody had locked me out. Somebody had locked me out. And within a nanosecond, like a flash, I transmuted, I changed, and I started kicking the door and screaming. I don't know, I'm not going to scream, but I, you know, 5 years ago I told you what I was screaming, but I said it was the F word, and I said, who the locked this door? And all of a sudden the door opened up, and it was my wife with one of the babies in her arms saying, what's the problem? I mean, that's how fast I transformed from incredibly spiritual person, you know, to monster man, you know what I mean? which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's a bad thing for the. I mean, obviously, I made amends and I said I was sorry and everything like that, and you know, but it's not necessarily a bad thing to be brought down a notch. It's not, you know, they said ego deflation is an important. Dr. Tebow said for alcoholics, and you know, and you know that happens to me. I'm 30 years sober now, and that happens to me now, from time to time, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. To have a clear understanding that you ain't perfect yet. You know, don't get too well by Thursday. You know, so and it's what you do with that fact that I ain't perfect. Because I'm the guy who goes on diets, you know, and does well for a week, and then I take one bite of something, I say, well, what the hell, I might as well go off of it. Because if I can't do it perfect, you know, if I can't do it perfect, and the only thing I've done perfect in here, the only thing I've done perfect, is not drink. That's it. You know, and you know, I sort of think that's probably the only thing you really have to do 100% perfect. You know, I mean, it's nice if you, I think we got to get the other stuff perfected, but you know, that's the only thing you got to do really perfect. This AA thing's a real mystery to me. A real mysterious deal. You know, no matter how much I learn about this thing, no matter how much I know about this thing, no matter how much I live this thing, they'll always, because God's a part of it. And God's a mystery, you know. I can't even imagine infinity. I can't imagine some of this. And no matter how much I know about this stuff, or I believe about this stuff, or I learn about this stuff, in the end, it's a mystery. I don't really know how it's just happening. You know, because even in the end of the promises, as you actually see the promise, you know, we have a pamphlet in AA. I forgot the name of the pamphlet, where it talks about when John the Baptist guys go to see Jesus and they say, are you the Messiah? Do we have to wait for somebody else? And he says, just tell them what you see. The blind see, the deaf hear, and the poor in spirit have the good news preached to them. And it's and you know, that's, you know, it's like the old Amazing Grace. I was blind. This is what I know. This is what I really know. One day, I looked a man in this is what you know. This is the only thing you know, really. This is the only thing you know. If somebody asks you, explain AA or how it happened, this is the only thing anybody in here really knows. I looked a guy in the eye one day and I said, I couldn't stop drinking. I need help, I couldn't stop drinking. The next day I stopped drinking. That's all you know. You don't know how this thing works. You think, you may think, you may have all sorts of opinions, but here's what you know. You know you couldn't stop drinking before you came into AA. You came to this crazy place, not understanding anything, you picked up a white chip and you stopped drinking. And you know something? You may not know crap. You may not understand God. You may not understand anything. But you want something? Just that fact, that thing that you don't even know how it works, will keep you coming back to AA, because all you know is you couldn't, and now you can. All you know is that one day you felt like crap and you wanted to kill yourself, and now you're grateful to be alive. All you know that one day you resented everybody in your entire life and you hated yourself, and now you want to live and you feel good about yourself. All you know is, once it was like this, and now I'm like this, and some book says God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves, and you have no idea how it works, and we would love to think we know how it works, and believe we know why it works, and listen to people we think know how it works, but in the end, all we know is there's something working here. There's something working here, and it's working. You know, and it wasn't working out there. You know, and so that's the deal. I picked up a one-year medallion when I was 1 year sober, which is sort of like the way it works. And the day after I picked up the medallion, I woke up the next morning and I had lost it. I couldn't find it. And I mean, who knows how this thing works? I mean, you know how you learn about this thing? On the street. You know, I mean, I'm a big proponent of reading the books. I'm a real proponent of reading the literature. I'm a real proponent of getting a sponsor and being mentored and listening to people. Not arguing with people, listening to people that have 20, 30 years, trying to figure what's going on with them. And I'm a big proponent of that because that's how it worked for me sitting at the feet of other people. You know? But the fact of the matter is, where this stuff comes together, where the crunch comes together, is as you experience it and apply it to your life out there on the streets. Because somehow, some way, when I take this stuff and everything my sponsor says to me, and I walk outside these doors or even inside these rooms, and stuff happens, and they twist me around, and I sort of somehow use this or don't use this, stay sober, all of a sudden, one day, I come to a realization. It just becomes clear to me. It's just clear. Things become clear. And one day, something became clear to me. I can't even tell you how it became clear to me. It just became clear to me. And this thing's been clear to me ever since I've been sober for 30 years now. And it came clear to me when I was 1 year sober. And I got a medallion. It said it had one on it. 1 year medallions, they say one. And I got up and I put it in my pocket. You know, I picked it up and everybody clapped. And, you know, it's a big deal 1 year. And I put it in my pocket and I went to sleep. And the next morning I woke up and I couldn't find it. I couldn't find my 1 year medallion. And anybody here who's approaching 1 year or has 1 year, you know how important that is, that 1 year medallion. And I ripped apart my room. I was throwing stuff all over the place, just ripping apart, going through the room, because I knew that that meant I was going to drink. That if I couldn't find that 1 year medallion, well, sure, you don't know what it's like. I wasn't too well. I was going to drink. And somehow, somewhere, and I don't even know where this came from, during the ripping, and I couldn't find it, never have been able to find it, somewhere in the ripping apart of my room and everything like that, a thought came to me. I don't even know where the thought came from. And I think it's part of our literature. It's probably somewhere in the literature about symbols and stuff. The thought came to me, he says, you know, Russell, you're not sober because of any material thing. You're not sober because of any material. You're not even sober because of a sponsor or because of a group or because of all this stuff. I said, he says, what is keeping you sober, what's working in you is invisible. And that, and it occurred to me that my sobriety must be based on something and must be anchored to something that cannot be lost. Cannot be lost. It can't be anchored. It can't be anchored to anything that can die. It can't be anchored to anything that I can say, where did it go? It can't be anchored to anything that the IRS can grab. Or my wife can take in a divorce. Or it can't be anchored to any living. It's got to have come. And you want to know something? I believe that it did come from something other than a material thing. And that these things, these little chips and medallions and whatever it is, lives and houses, are just symbols of that deal. And they may go and they may fade away or something may happen. But the thing, that thing that they represent is always going to be there, and I can't lose it. And I don't even know where that came from. I just believe that. And so the other night I picked up a 30-year medallion. I guess it's got XXX on it, like poison or something. I don't know what that is. And thank you. I picked up a 30-year medallion, and it was nice. Everybody was saying, let me see it. You know, I passed it around, and I woke up the next morning, and I don't know where it is. You know, history repeats itself. You know, and that's sort of like been the way it is for me with all the medallions. It's something else. It's something invisible. It's something more. And in a sense, that's sort of what I want to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about something called focus. What is your focus? The importance of focus. They say in the Old Testament, they say where the people lose their vision, where there is no vision, the people perish. What is your vision? What do you think sobriety is all about? What do you think this deal is all about? Let me read this poem to you. And now I'm going to read you some literature. It says, this is called The Duck. I've read this before, but I'll read it again. It's a good time to read it. Six Step. Guy in the Glass. You know, I want to tell you something interesting before I get to this poem. You know, if you look at the Big Book, which is our basic text, I'm going to tell you how mysterious crazy this program is. This program will drive you nuts. I talked last week when I was talking about fear, that whole thing last week on the fifth step, mostly about fear. I talked about how what I recognized, I think it was last week when I talked about that, one of the dichotomies that seemed to be present in the struggle, and they talk about in the Bible, you can't serve both God and mammon. You can't be focused on the world and worried about the world and worried about the things and also focused upon God. You know, the old Buddhist man who stands in the middle of the road gets hit by both sides. And I know for years, that takes years to develop. And I'm not even saying I'm there, but it takes years to develop to somehow, there's one part of me that worries all the time, that was worried all the time about stuff that I had no control over or limited control over. Things, money, cars, women, prestige, stuff the outside world that seemed to be attacked, and I had to defend it and work, and then I come in here, and they don't want to talk to me about stuff. As a matter of fact, the more I talk about stuff, they want to tell me, don't look at that stuff. That stuff, and what do you mean, that stuff is important? That's my life, that's not your life. And all of a sudden you start reading stuff in the book that says, let no man say that he's got to have his family back. His family back, for God's sakes. You know, car, job, or anything like that says, burn the idea in the alcoholic's mind that he can get well and feel good and not drink, regardless of losing everything, as long as he's dependent upon God. Whatever the heck that is, some invisible thing. And my whole life is focused, my entire life, on getting that Rolex watch or getting that new car, you know, or getting that gal or getting that job or making money or stuff like that. And it seems the whole world says that's what the deal is, because I walk out of here and I see a billboard that says Rolex, or it says Smirnoff, or it says Cadillac. There's a good-looking blonde. I turn on TV, it's all about that. The whole world is avoiding that stuff. And I come in here and you guys tell me, well, worried about it. That's not important. That's not important. And I get an hour of you guys telling me it's not important, don't worry about that, you haven't had a drink today. You know what I mean? Thank God for that. Look at the things you're grateful for. You guys tell me that for an hour, and I go out there, and for 23 hours, I get pummeled with the other stuff. And I wonder why I'm so nuts. Boy, you got to be so focused and so on guard and so aware of what's going on. Because, you know, for those people, when they're inundated with it out there, in the TV and the radios and the news, the worst that'll happen with them is they'll just die of a heart attack, or cancer, or sucking their thumb, or get depressed, you know, or be miserable. But for us, what happens with us is we drink. We drink. So they may actually make it to cradle the grave, you know, be worried about all that stuff, you know, but we'll drink. So we got to somehow, even though we only have ourselves together for an hour, or maybe we got to somehow fight that deal and realize that that's where the battle is. You know, and so I'm looking at this book, which is really, that's what it's all about. It's about, this whole book is about developing a relationship with God. That's what it says from beginning to end, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing and read everything, because I do it at every meeting, and if you miss the other meetings, and you haven't read the book, I don't know what to say about it. I'm not going to go through it, but it's very clear. This whole thing is about developing a relationship with God, and if you don't believe me, just read the steps, for God's sakes. Just read the steps. You know, where it says, start with step 3, where it talks about making a commitment, a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, and move up to step 11 as you go through all the steps, where it clears away, you know, so you can bask in the sunshine of the Spirit. We can get past 4 and 5, we'll get you closer and develop that relationship, right down to step 11, where it says, now that we have this relationship, you know, now that we have it, let's try to get closer in that relationship. And then number 12 says, now carry this thing to other people. Read the big book and vision for you, saying, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Read the part which says, we've been rocketed, we've experienced much of heaven, we've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, of which we have not even dreamed. Because, why? Because the central factor in our lives today is that our Creator lives in our lives, you know, and he is really doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. Read the promises. See where it's infused throughout this entire book, and that's what it's about. It's about that relationship. You know, and that's what the sixth step is about. It's about that relationship. All these steps are about that relationship. It's not about to get us psychologically. Well, we may clear up psychologically. We may clear up emotionally. There's a lot of things that may clear up. But we clear up not because we get smarter. I know a lot of real smart, miserable people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you something. They'll sarcastically cut you down. They'll hurt you. They'll do a lot of things they did before they came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're brilliant. But they're brilliant. And I know a lot of really smart people that can't stop drinking. And they're real smart. They'll pick this thing apart, piece by piece, and tell you why it doesn't work, or why it's stupid, or why I'm stupid, or other people are stupid. And then I know about the people that I used to hang out with, and they were just at peace with themselves and happy, and helping other people. And you get to make decisions to which deal you want to go on that thing. So here it is, I'm sitting here dealing with this sixth step, and here's where sometimes the rules are sort of, you would think, here's what you would think, that the most, there's 164 pages in the text of the big book, which is our basic text. Of the 164 pages, the steps really end, in a sense end, they go through the steps on page 103. About 100 pages are basically the steps through working with others. Of the 100 pages working with others, let me see. The first 75 pages, three quarters of the book, the first 75 pages are devoted to steps 1 through 5. You understand? A lot. There's charts on step 4. There's a whole lot of stuff on step 5. There's tons of stuff on step 3. The next 27 pages until the end are devoted to steps 8 through 12. You know how much is devoted to step 6 in the big book? You know how much? You want to take a guess? 3 sentences. And actually, it's really only 1 sentence. But they have it sandwiched in between 2 others. Now, this may not seem like a big deal to you, because what's step 6? It may not seem like a big deal, because what's step 6 after all? Until you read the 12 and 12, where it says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. This is not step 3. Not step 5, not step 10 or step, it says this is the step. And now I happen to believe, based on what I've seen, that there's a lot of separation going on here. People are constantly being separated. People do get separated out in step 3. They do get sifted out. I love the word sifted. You know, I said, you know, there's this great line out of the Bible. You know, I mean, I'm a Bible guy. I read the thing as to you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. Don't think because I do it, you do it. But you know, like, you know, the first 100 people, if you read Dr. Bob and Goodall, that's all they did the first 4 years, read the Bible. And there's a great line where Jesus says to Peter, he says, I've allowed Satan to sift. You're going to be sifted. I like that line, sifted. You hang in here enough. You know what it is to sift flour, to sift the lumps out of it, to sift things? You hang out here long enough, you're going to see the world and its people and the stuff of the world sift people out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to see the marriages, you're going to see the relationships, you're going to see the money struggles, you're going to see the resentments, you're going to see the cars, you're going to see the life, you're going to see everything in this world gang up on everybody's in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's going to sift you out. And you're going to walk into a room one day, like I walked into the car room, and you're going to see 10 guys with 1 year, and 5 guys with 2 years, and 8 guys with 3 years, and 2 guys with 4, 3 guys with 5, and nobody with 6, and 6 guys with 7, and nobody with 8, and 1 guy with 9, and 1 guy with 10, nobody with 11, nobody with 12, nobody with 13, 1 guy with 14, 3 guys with 15, you know, nobody with 16, nobody with 17, nobody in 18, nobody in 20, 1 guy with 20, and you're going to see the sifting. It's going to be, the sifting's going to be real apparent to you. Now, I don't know what the statistics are. I know the things I want to quote, but I mean, this is the step. There's a separation. This is the step that separates the men from the boys. The line in the big book, it says this. It says, this is on page 76. This is what they devote to step 6. Isn't that incredible? The thing that they say 15 years later is the step that separates the men from the boys, they give 3 lines to in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says this. Are we now ready to let God... this is after the 5th step. It says, are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things that we admitted are objectionable and which stands in the way of our relationship with Him? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. That's step 6. That's it, folks. So what do you do with that if you got 3 years, if you got 5 years? I'm telling you, I didn't understand it. You understand it the best way. You understand these things the best way you can understand these things at the time you're doing these things. But I can tell you this. It has something to do... the only thing I can tell you is I don't know what the truth is. I get impressions. You learn a little bit. You know, it's like it said at the end of this thing. What is the last thing they say in the book? These are the guys. We're following these guys. You know what the last thing they say in the book? The guys that we're following. The guys that you're hooking your life onto. That you're depending your life onto. You know what they say in the book at the very end? Last paragraph, he says, we know but a little. I don't know about you, this makes me feel so good. You know what I mean? The guys that you're coming in here, following, reading their material, following everything they say, which, crazily enough, seems to be working for you, the last thing they say in the book is, hey, we know but a little. God will constantly disclose to you more. That's how you're going to learn this thing. So, man, you don't trust in God, you're going to have some problems. Because even they, the founders, knew but a little. But they believed that if you focused on him, you would get more. And I believe that too. And it's happened. So when that day, when I lost that 1 year medallion, and somehow going crazy, going nuts, is only an alcohol can. You know what happens when alcohol goes nuts. I got to find it. Where is it? You took my medallion. I can't believe I can't find my, you know what alcohol crazy, you know how it is when you go crazy and obsessive. I mean, to somehow get to a point, how does that happen? Where you calm down and you realize, you accept the fact that it's not going to show up, you're not going to find it, but you're not going to drink, and somehow, some way, learn that deal, that your sobriety comes from a power other than a piece of metal. And to understand that is an amazing thing. So to somehow understand after 30 years, to be able to see that what they're talking about in here is about, you know, I may not understand about entirely getting rid of stuff. Because let's face it, I don't even know all the stuff I have to get rid of. You know, the stuff I thought I had to get rid of in 1 year, and then there was more stuff I thought I had to get rid of in 3 years, and then 10 years I learned about more stuff, and now at 30 years, there's other stuff. You learn about other stuff. You know why? You get pissed off and somebody pisses you off, or something happens, or you get upset. And then you do that 10-step axiom. Whenever I'm upset, there's something wrong with me. You do a 4-step fit. You look at it, and all of a sudden it pops out. Man, I got a problem with this. And all of a sudden you're dealing with stuff that you've never dealt with before. So as you go along, you learn that there's even more things in front of you blocking you from God. So how do you deal with this thing? And the only thing I can tell you is ultimately what I've learned, what I've been inspired to know, what this means to me is about focus and motivation. And maybe that's why this is the engine that runs AA. This is the thing that takes a guy with 30 years and says, not only haven't I made it, I'm not even close to it. I'm not even close. I've just scratched the surface. I need more. I'll do anything to get more. How can I get more? As opposed to just settling and saying, well, I got 30 years. I don't have to worry about anything anymore. I got it made now. And how do you instill that in somebody? I can't instill. You either got that deal going or you don't have that deal going. When you get what you want, this is the guy in the glass. When you get what you want in your struggle for pelf and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that guy has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass. The fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the guy staring back in the glass. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear up to the end and you've passed the most dangerous, difficult test if the guy in the glass is your friend. You may be like Jack Horner and chisel a plum and think you're a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. You can fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you cheated the guy in the glass. I got a lot of guys in AA that I sponsor. You know, some guy was talking to me, how many people you sponsor? And I said, I don't even know you have to count them. I mean, after 30 years, it's hard to count. But I got a lot of guys in AA that I know that are sober today and do very well and make a lot of money and everything, and they're miserable. They're miserable, and I can't talk to them. They'll call me up and say, I'm miserable. What should I do? And I'll tell them what to do. I'll suggest what to do. And they can't do it. They can't do it. They literally cannot do it. Because to do it, they have to turn from this and go to that. And their whole life is about this. To do it, they would have to miss the Super Bowl. Now, you think that's funny. No, I'm not saying you have to miss the Super Bowl. I'm not saying anybody who has to stay sober, if you're watching the Super Bowl, you can't be sober. But there are some people that they can be sober 20, 30 years, and they'll never progress further because they cannot miss the Super Bowl. Because that's how important it is to them. And I can tell you this, if you put the Super Bowl before God, you're going to have some real problems down the road with a whole lot of things. And I can tell you this, there will be times in your life where you're called upon to put the Super Bowl or your wife or your child or something else in your life, something in AA, you'll be called to make a choice between something you idolize, and I use the word idol for a reason, that you depend upon, that you focus on, that you think is the most important thing, you'll be called upon to make a choice between that and something invisible. And you will not be able to make the choice. You'll be sober 20 years or 25 years. People will be patting you on the back. You will not be able to make the choice. You will not be able to turn. You will not be able to go down to that treatment center because the Super Bowl game is on. You will not be able to do that meeting because the Super Bowl game is on. And you will not be able, because you got to go to that party. You will not be able to do that. And I'm going to tell you something. Somewhere down the road, you'll be miserable. You'll be terrible. Something bad will happen. It'll be a bad thing. And you'll never know what the problem, you'll never even guess what the problem is or where it happened, because it won't necessarily happen immediately. It won't happen. It doesn't work like that in AA. You know it doesn't work like that in AA. You know, when somebody drinks in AA, you know, the slip started like 6 months before that. It started when they missed that meeting or didn't agree to do that service, or somebody, it slips, it's 6 months before that. And you'll make that decision, and 6 months down the road, you'll be depressed. They'll be seeing the doctor and popping pills. And you won't even know that it's because you made that decision instead of that decision. That's how maniacal, that's how patient, that's how powerful this disease is. That's how it works. It depends, and it depends upon what? It depends upon focused. What happens is my sponsor used to talk about something called elation. He used to talk about elation and, now I forgot the other word, I'll remember it, but you know, just being cocksure of yourself. And people would come in here and they say, what do they say? It's easy to rest on your laurels. And head, people come in here and start resting on their laurels. They'll start thinking, well, I've got it made. I'm okay now. And all of a sudden, their focus goes. Their focus goes to the football games. Their focus goes to the playing poker. The focus goes to the internet. The focus goes to the girls. The focus goes to the guys. The focus goes to the cars. The focus goes someplace else. And as a matter of fact, if you try to talk to them, you know, if you know anything about alcoholics, you try to talk to them, you try to steer them in the other direction. They, you know, what happens? If they don't want, if an alcoholic doesn't want to be steered in another direction, you know what he gets? He gets mad at you. He gets pissed. He turns you off. He figures out in his mind, using his mind, how screwed up you are and who do you help you think you are and how somehow you're sick and there's something wrong with you. And, you know, we can be blind and be in denial, believe me, with 20 years. I can be blind. What about the focus? Does that have anything to do with step six, the focus? In 60 AD, the Apostle Paul wrote this. I want to read this to you, and then I'm going to read you something in AA. You know these guys were reading the Bible for the first 4 years. This is what the Apostle Paul said about it. And I don't want to go into the Apostle Paul. Anybody knows about him? He wrote 13 books in the second part. You know, he's a pretty wild guy. This is what he says. I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to read something on the sixth step. You know, this thing's been around for a while. These spiritual exercises, these spiritual truths, these things that you're following that you think were developed by Bill Wilson. Even Bill Wilson didn't say, I invented this. Even Bill Wilson knew where this came from. It came. You know who he was sponsored by? You guys think he was sponsored by the guy who kept on drinking? What's the guy's name? Nah, forget it. The guys that sponsor him were Father Ed Dowling. Guys who sponsored him were, you know, Sam Shoemaker. Were a couple of clergymen. He even said the clergymen were involved in the 12 steps. He even said it was Sam Shoemaker's deal. You know what I mean? If you read his writings, I mean, you know, I mean, that's the bottom line. These things have been around for thousands of years. This is 60 AD. 60 AD. Long time ago. Farther back than 1939. This is the Apostle Paul talking about the sixth step. Talking about his life, talking about the sixth step. He says, I don't mean to say that I have already achieved these things or that I have already reached perfection, but I keep working towards that day when I will finally be all that God saved me for and wants me to be. No, I am still not all I should be, but I am focusing all my energies. I am focusing all my energies on this one thing. Not 20 things, not the car. I'm focusing all my energies on this one thing. Forgetting the past and looking forward to what lies ahead. I strain to reach the end of the race and receive the prize for which God is calling us up to heaven. Did you hear that? Now here's the sixth step. What does that have to do with anything? Here's the sixth step in our book. The thing that separates the men from the boys. And here's the test as to whether or not you are even doing the sixth step. Here's the test that's laid out in the book. Whether you like it or not, I didn't write this thing. Just write New York and tell them you object to the test. It's only been around for that, you know? This is, hey, listen, conference approved, okay? Here you go. This is where this came from, okay? This is the step that separates the men from the boys. So declares a well-loved clergyman. Whoa. Whoa. But I'm spiritual, not religious. Well, it's lucky our founders didn't feel that way, because they hobnobbed with clergymen. They didn't think religion was a dirty word. This is the step that separates the men from the boys, so declares a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of AA's greatest friends. He goes on to explain. He goes on to explain. The clergyman. The guy who's telling you this is the step that's going to separate you out. The clergy guy. So next time somebody's asking you, well, how do you know you're separated? How do you know you're doing good or doing well in AA? He says, well, we learned it. A clergyman told us. A priest, a rabbi told us. Next time you hear somebody say, we don't want to hang around those guys. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness and honesty to try repeatedly, step six, ready to have God remove all his defects of character, straining to reach the end of the race to get better, on all his faults, without any reservations whatsoever, has indeed, now here's the test, come a long way spiritually and is therefore entitled to be called a man or a woman who is sincerely trying to grow in the image and likeness of his Creator. So you tell me you're doing the sixth step, and this is what I say to you. This is what I say to you. I say, oh, you are? And say, yeah. I said, so you're sincerely trying to grow in the image and likeness of your Creator. And you say to me, you say, what? I said, no, you say, no, I'm spiritual, not religious. No, I don't. And I say, well, but aren't you trying to grow in the image and likeness of your Creator? He says, no, I'm not trying to do that. I'm just doing the sixth step. I'm getting rid of all these defects. For what reason? For what reason? Because in this book, you do it in order to grow in the image, his image and likeness. To be perfect. To be like him. Not that we ever get there. He says, no, no, I don't do that. I'm spiritual. I'm not religious. What does it mean? What does it mean to unhook this thing from him? What does it mean to unhook this thing and just use the words to think they have some sort of meaning, to think that spirituality has some sort of meaning outside of God, outside of him, and somehow that these words sort of stand on their own? What, I'm just going to be like a better person? I got it. This is the new song in AA, right? Just do the next right thing. You know, if I could do the next right thing without him, I wouldn't be an Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I knew what's right and I know what's wrong, and somehow to me, it seems like I shouldn't have to give back the money. I stole it, but I shouldn't have to give it back. Somehow, the last thing I can do is that, and I may be able to do the next right thing 15 times in a row, but that 16th time, I'm screwing up, because to me, it's like doing jail time. There's a difference between under the gun doing the next right thing and focused all, that's like living all your life under the gun doing the next right, and I'm just not focused enough or good enough or strong enough to do that. The only way I could ever do the next right thing is if I want to do the next right thing. And the only reason I'd ever want to do the next right thing is not for me or my wife or my kids. The only reason I've ever wanted to do the next right thing is because I don't want to embarrass him. Because I believe I owe something to him. Because I'm grateful to him. And I don't want to let him down. Let me tell you something. I'll screw me over like that. I'll drink on me like that. You know why? Because deep down inside, I don't give a crap about me. I've proven it 100 times. I'm a piece of crap. I mean nothing. But you want something? I don't want to let him down. That's why sometimes, because I don't want to let you down. I don't want to let my sponsee down. I don't want to let him down. I got to focus on him. Later on in step six, at the very end, and then I'm going to close it up. You know, what happens in here is there is a separation out. And it says right here, it says, some people, of course, may conclude that they are indeed ready to have all such defects taken from them. But even these people, if they construct the list of still milder defects, will be obliged to admit that they prefer to hang on to some of them. Therefore, here it goes. Therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to, here's the deal, and I understand this deal because I'm a lawyer. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life. I know what that means. I know what it means to settle a case. I know what it means to settle. It means instead of going through the trial, we settle for less. We settle for what will make us good. We want to, we only as much perfection as will get us by in life, according, of course, to our various and sundry ideas of what will get us by. So the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for self-determined objective and for the perfect objective is that is of God. And what does it look like in AA? I'll tell you what it looks like. It looks like this. I'll just give you one example. There's a million of them. And you sponsor enough people for 30 years, you see them. And I don't even know them all, but you can see them. Here's one example. So-and-so is doing the steps down at the Carl Gables group. Let's go see him. I heard he's very good. You know, he's doing step 6. He says, no, I've already been to a meeting today. No, I don't even want to take a drink. Well, have you been to a meeting? I don't even want to drink. It's not about getting better. It's not about getting closer. It's not about focus. I only need 3 meetings a week not to drink. What's that? Has nothing to do with getting better. Or it has to do with what? This is, I'm doing precisely the number of meetings. I've already got it measured out, the number of meetings I'm taking. This like I'm taking aspirin. I've got my, listen, thank you very much, but I only need 5 meetings a week to get this. You know, I got to spend the rest of time. How about this? I need balance in my life. Balance? I don't want to go to too many meetings. I might get to. I don't want to be like a guy Russell. I need some balance. I used to walk into a bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, walk out at 4 o'clock in the morning. With a wife and kid, 12 hours of drinking. That's what I know about balance, you know? And I go to an hour AA meeting, you know, three hours a week, and like I don't want to get out of balance and spend the rest of the time out there with the Rolex watches and the craziness. The only way I've ever found any emotional balance is giving my entire life to this thing and focused on this deal. And if you don't think that pisses people off, let me tell you something. If you're in here right now, and that ain't your deal, and you don't even like that deal, you don't even like me here saying this deal, you're not going to like what I'm saying. But you want to know something? Here's what the deal's going to be. 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 15 years from now, or 20 years from now, when you're on your 5th treatment center, or your 7th divorce, or maybe you're sober, but you feel kind of crappy about yourself, and you don't believe you're getting somewhere, maybe you'll think back on this meeting and say, maybe that guy wasn't all full of shit. You know, maybe I should have listened to him. Maybe you had something to say. Maybe it was the right deal. You know what I mean? You know, I'm a firm believer that you can't rob an alcoholic of his desperation. I'm not going to convince you. I'll tell you what's going to convince you. Life, just like with the Apostle Paul, just like with Bill Wilson, just like all these guys who devoted and were focused on their life. What do you think Bob was about? It says if you're an atheist or agnostic, have any sort of intellectual pride that keeps you in this program, I feel sorry for yourself. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down. You think these guys were any more committed or any more zealous or crazy? What do you think they were like? They were saying, this guy, take it or leave it? They were focused. You want what they had, but you don't want to be like, you don't want to be focused like them. You don't think they were focused on this stuff? You don't think they devoted their entire life? We don't even know what Bill Wilson did after he came to Alcoholics Anonymous. He never had a job again. His whole life was about going to meetings, writing books, and helping alcoholics. You don't think these guys were focused on this stuff? Are you focused on this stuff like they're focused on this stuff? Are you? Are you pissed because I'm suggesting that you may want to look at that? Well, you know, whenever you're upset, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with you. You want to check that out. I'm not upset that you're upset. Why are you upset with me? God bless you. We'll talk about step 7 next week.